Good morning. This is Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in for Mark Bayshore at Current State on WKAR 90.5 FM. I'm the editor of the Michigan Information and Research Service, and we got a great show planned for you today. In case you haven't heard, our next pop-up stories is a storytelling event, and that's happening tomorrow evening. We're going to be at Reach Studio Art Center in Lansing at 6 p.m., and we're going to have a segment on that a little later in the program. But first, the National Human Trafficking Resource Center reports that in 2015, Michigan officials received more than 700 calls related to human trafficking. Now, human trafficking is the practice of coercing someone into forced labor or sexual slavery. A conference this week in Ann Arbor seeks to find strategies to eliminate the crisis in Michigan. The gathering is the first of its kind ever held in the state. We have two guests joining us today to talk about the scope of human trafficking in Michigan. The Honorable Michelle Rick is a judge in the 29th Circuit Court, which covers Clinton and Gratiot counties. She's a member of the Michigan Human Trafficking Commission. And also here in studio is Jane White. She's the director of the Michigan Human Trafficking Task Force. Thanks to both of you for being here today on Current State.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge, let's start with you. You each represent different entities working to combat human trafficking. Let's start off by distinguishing the Michigan Human Trafficking Commission from the task force. Judge Rick, you're on the commission. What's the mission and what's your role within it?
Well, the mission of the task force is to continue the work of the, of the commission is to continue the work of the first commission that was formed several years ago. I was appointed in 2015, as well as other members of law enforcement, prosecutors, victim advocates, etc. And our charge is there are many things that we have to do. We are looking to promote community awareness for human trafficking. We are charged with looking at the existing laws and making recommendations to improve upon those laws. We are charged with training professionals, be they healthcare professionals, law enforcement officers, courts, etc., so that there is a better awareness related to human trafficking.
Now, Jane, you lead the task force. Now, how is it organized and what's your mandate?
We're organized in terms of bringing agencies and individuals together to bring three factions. One is awareness, and awareness includes a multitude of kinds of things, whether it is working with the legislature in terms of how best to serve victims. It is whether or not training is involved. We do a lot of training in law enforcement, medical people, doctors, nurses, school teachers. The second one is supporting prosecution, which is really important, and again, a wide array of services. And the last is providing support to victims as such, the focus.
You know, it's kind of surprising to me that human trafficking is still an issue in today's society. Sometimes we live in our own bubbles. We don't even think about it existing, but there's been a keen focus on it lately, Judge Rick. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that we've come to realize that we need to look beneath the surface and not accept things at face value, and that there are individuals who are highly vulnerable, be they adult or minors, who find themselves in trafficking situations. Runaways are particularly vulnerable. And, you know, when we talk about trafficking, it's important to remember that there are different types of trafficking. There's labor trafficking and there's sex trafficking. And with respect to labor, there are individuals who may be kept in bondage, if you will, by virtue of their work relationship. Are they migrants, for example, and they have to give up their passports when they come to work in the United States? Are there requirements that they pay to leave their employment? That would be another sign of someone who's labor trafficked. With respect to sex trafficking, which again can affect men, women, boys, girls, there are signs that may not readily be apparent if not paid attention to that indicate there's something far more devious and ugly than what the surface would present.
Now, when you're talking about sex trafficking, are you talking about girls or young women who are transported around the country, or can this just be localized where they're kind of beholden to somebody and they're staying put, but they're beholden to somebody and they have to actually go out and prostitute themselves, I guess, for lack of a better word?
Exactly. I would say it is the latter.
Okay.
And I would again reinforce that, that this happens regardless of gender. It can be men, it can be boys, it can be women or girls, but yes, it doesn't. There is no requirement that an individual be transported across state lines or country lines in order for there to be trafficking.
Jane White, tell our listeners how you got interested in this subject and why it's important to you.
It's important to me because slavery still exists. It has always existed in the United States, but it's hard to believe in today's world that it does. The third issue that the judge, she addressed the other two so very well, is the supply chain. And that is a very sobering thought that all of us are involved in receiving services or merchandise or kinds of things that make our life better by someone who is actually in the slave trade, often children who have been exploited and are trafficked. The reason that I was involved, because I'm a former police officer and worked at MSU in criminal justice and saw some astounding kinds of things in terms of organized crime, in terms of partnerships with people who utilize right under our noses, children, men, women, in terms of actual slave labor.
You're listening to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in for Mark Bayshore. The topic of the morning so far is human trafficking. Judge Michelle Rick from the 29th Circuit Court is joining us, as well as Jane White, the director of Human Trafficking Task Force here for the state of Michigan. Jane, human trafficking is complex, and it's, some reports call it the second fastest growing business in the world. Is it even possible to quantify the size of that?
No, unfortunately, it is not, because we have not yet qualified a system to be able to give us accurate data and information. And that's one of the really top needs that exists, is to be able to quantify and qualify issues of what trafficking really is, because we do live in a world where we want numbers. And so when those kinds of things are brought about, it's very difficult because we don't have adequate research. Mm-hmm. Do we know it's a problem? Absolutely. There isn't a community in this state that probably has not been somewhat impacted by the issues of examples of human trafficking.
Judge, your jurisdiction is Clinton and Gratiot County. What type of human trafficking cases do you see in your courtroom?
Well, I think that we are hopefully going to become more educated by virtue of the conference that will be held tomorrow in Ann Arbor. But cases can involve charges of domestic violence, a resist and obstruct. They can be family law cases. They can be civil cases. Really, any case has the potential of there being a trafficking situation underneath. And our conference is designed as such that we're bringing together teams. In my community, we're bringing law enforcement, victim services, probation department personnel, child protective services personnel, and myself. And one of the goals of our conference is to get these teams talking so that we not only become better educated, but better prepared so that we recognize cases that have an element of human trafficking.
Now, Judge, going off that here, when you hear of human trafficking, I think the initial thought is that we've got one person who's carrying around like five people in the back of a van and they're doing sexual favors for individuals. But as you explained earlier, it's not that It's not that cut and dry, that there's many layers to it. And the legislature has tried to combat it by passing more legislation to try and bring a higher focus to it. Is that the answer, or is there something else that can be done to try and push back at this growing epidemic?
I would say it's such a huge problem. There is no one answer or no one silver bullet. It requires community eyes and ears. It requires a coordination of a variety of players. Recently, there was a toll-free number that had been posted at area rest stops, and that's not only for victims who may find themselves in a situation of being trafficked, but also for individuals who have suspicions about trafficking. And that National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline number is 1-888-3737-888. But it takes all of us.
Jane, you see what happens to victims outside of the legal setting. What does it take to build a reliable, cooperating network of services to help the victims?
Well, an important concept is the issue of collaboration. And collaboration requires trust that often it does not exist between our very good kinds of services that it do. So when we talk about needs and those kinds of things, our number one need is the issue of housing. And that has been identified nationally as well as in our state of Michigan, that when there is a rescue of those who are involved, whether labor or sexual exploitation, that immediately we have housing that is available for them. Other kinds of services that are crucial are legal services, psychiatric counseling services, health services. We know identification of victims through the health system rarely exists, but the medical community has really responded well in terms of training to identify these kinds of things. So as you indicated, there is just a myriad of needs and recognition and support financially in terms of the services available.
So do you believe that people are adequately trained for these?
No.
Oh.
And it's not because people don't want to be. It is, as the judge indicated, it's hidden underground in terms of what it is. We don't recognize it. I've never conducted a police training where there haven't been officers who have come up who don't indicate that they indeed had cases of human trafficking but didn't recognize that's what they were. We're still putting victims in jail. And yet they are victims. We had a call last weekend from a minor who was involved in trafficking, and they were ready to put her in a detention facility. She doesn't belong in a detention facility. She's a victim.
Now, Judge, what do you do in these kind of situations when you have people who are victims of human trafficking before you in the courtroom?
Well, Kyle, again, I get back to the need and to follow up on what Jane has said in terms of collaboration. You know, I have my own niche, and my niche is to assess cases, and if it's a criminal matter, to impose a punishment for the person standing before me. I need to make sure that the right person is standing before me. I can tell you that on one occasion, a while back, I had a young woman who had been convicted of not a sex offense, but a drug-related offense. And it came to my attention that there were some connections she had to others that gave me great concern that she may have been a victim of human trafficking. And so one of my punishments or penalties, if you will, because that's what it is in the criminal context, was I required that there be coordination with Manassa over on the west side of the state, who provides services for trafficked victims. I did not impose a jail sanction for her because, as Jane indicated, jail is not where victims belong.
You're listening to Current State on WKAR 90.5 FM. I'm Kyle Malin, editor of the MERS newsletter, filling in for Mark Bayshore. We're being joined right now with Judge Michelle Rick and Jane White. And the subject is human trafficking. And Judge, I want to get back to you on something Jane said about training in the legal system. What's your viewpoint on training and what can be done to improve that?
Well, it's vital, and it's vital that it be a collaborative training, which is why our conference is bringing together people from different disciplines so that we hear the same message, so that we can have an open dialogue that is not specific to a particular case, and that we can map out strategies for providing services to victims and to ensure that wrongdoers are prosecuted.
Jane, what is the most misunderstood aspect of human trafficking?
Probably that victims identify themselves. They do not identify themselves.
What do you mean by that? They don't consider themselves victims?
That's a good point that you just made. They do not. Very often, the word trafficking as such is absolutely foreign to them. It is only through talking what it is that they're involved with that we understand that there's unbelievable control on their lives. And the control has been made in terms of a promise that their life is going to be better, whether it is through sexual exploitation in a relationship or whether it is through labor trafficking on want a job. So when we talk about the fact of identifying victims, it's very, very difficult for us to fully understand, and that's why we need some research on this as to how we better identify victims.
There are some public information campaigns designed to prevent human trafficking. And this includes things like signs posted at highway rest stops, like the judge had mentioned, and other public places. Another well-known example is a project called SOAP, Save Our Adolescents from Prostitution, founded by a former HT victim, Teresa Flores. What's your take on how well these preventative strategies are working?
Any kind of strategy that might appear to have value is certainly looked at. But then again, we need to look at our resources and identify those that are effective. And we need to do that through reliable research. We really do, because we need to do in the right direction how effective kinds of things are to bring victims forward.
And Judge, what happens after this conference? And we've talked a little bit earlier about the conference that's coming up in Ann Arbor on human trafficking. What's going to keep an after-action report from gathering dust on the shelf?
Thank you. Well, again, our last piece of the day tomorrow will be to invite our teams to brainstorm and then to follow up in their respective communities with an action plan. The commission is dedicated not only to being available for those communities, but we also intend to make this a regular event. Just to give you some perspective, Kyle, we announced the conference to state court judges to assemble teams. And within several weeks, we were at capacity for 200 people. And we have a waiting list of over 160 people. So we know that there are communities that are anxious and desirous of getting more information so that they can plan and act accordingly.
Now, who are some of the, is there going to be a speaker at this conference? What does the agenda look like?
I'm glad that you asked that. Our agenda includes an overview of human trafficking by Elizabeth Campbell, who is at the University of Michigan at the Human Trafficking Clinic. We will have a presentation on FBI case studies and the Trafficking Task Force. I am personally delighted that a judge from Columbus, Ohio, by the name of Paul Herbert, is coming to talk about his catch court. And then we have breakout sessions so that our law enforcement judges and victim services providers can get a perspective from a group of panelists.
Well, that's very interesting. And Jane, I'm assuming you're going to be at this event too in Ann Arbor. Can you just give our listeners a little background where specifically it is and what time?
I will let the judge do that because I'm really not very good at addresses.
All right, please.
That's
judge.
Okay. We'll be at Weber's Inn in Ann Arbor, and we will begin about 8:30 and we'll go for the entire duration of the day.
We've been talking today about human trafficking in Michigan in advance of the first statewide conference to be held on the issue tomorrow in Ann Arbor. Michelle Rick is a circuit court judge presiding in Clinton and Gratiot counties. She's a member of the Michigan Human Trafficking Commission, and Jane White is the director of the Michigan Human Trafficking Task Force. Thanks to you both, and best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up on Current State, the East Lansing Public Library will reopen Saturday after a huge renovation project, and the dust is still settling.
Every single book came off of a shelf and has to go back on. We are cleaning the books because of all the dust that happens with construction.
Coming up, we talk with Director Kristen Shelley about what's new at the East Lansing Public Library. That's later this hour on Current State. For 35 years on the stage and on PBS, the Capital Steps comedy troupe have been skewering contemporary politics with skits and song parodies. With 2016 being an election year, there has been plenty for the group to make fun of. Current State's Jamie Paisley spoke with Mark Eaton, co-author of this year's Capital Steps, ahead of a two mid-Michigan appearances this weekend. The first is in Whiting, is at the Whiting in Flint, Sunday, October 2, followed by a Lansing Symphony Benefit performance on Monday, October 3. As ever, there is plenty of music from the American Songbook, including Hotel California, that classic song from the Eagles, but moved just one state to the east.
Welcome to the state of Arizona. Have your papers, please, or you'll have to leave. There isn't much room in the state of Arizona if you're darker than George Hamilton.
Mark Eaton, as co-author, do you kind of take current events and bring them into the new shows as they go on? For example, Monday night was the debate that happened, the first presidential debate between Trump and Clinton. Do you incorporate those that quickly into the segments?
Well, we try to. You know, if there's something, if there's some kind of breaking news, we certainly want to get it into the show as soon as possible. Now, we have had our version of a Trump-Clinton debate in the show for, you know, almost a month or so now, once they became the finals. So I don't think there was anything necessarily earth-shattering in last night's debate, other than maybe Donald sniffling more than folks thought he would. But, you know, if something happens, we try to get it into the show as soon as we can.
Where does the name The Capital Steps come from?
Well, the Capital Steps name actually comes from a famous scandal that happened back in the early 80s when Congressman Jenrette and his wife boasted that they had made whoopee on the Capitol steps.
That's an interesting little side note. You yourself, you've been with the group since 93 after being a lobbyist for about a decade, is that about right? You're working with lobbyists.
Well, I worked on the Hill for about a decade, and then I did do some lobbying for a few years, and then I lost my mind and started doing this full-time in 1999.
How many full-time people are part of the Capital Steps?
You know, at this point, pretty much everybody is full-time. We do have one woman who still works on the Hill and subs in occasionally as a part-time cast member. But at this point, with as many shows we're doing, especially in an election season, we really have to be able to travel at the drop of a hat. So pretty much everybody is full-time at this point.
Do you ever notice, as you take the show, the review to different places, is there a difference between the Beltway audience in Washington as opposed to the other kind of venues that you perform in?
Well, I think we're very conscious about making it you don't have to be a political junkie necessarily to get everything. I mean, in the early days of us, you know, we thought it would be hilarious to write a song that only people who are familiar with some subcommittee would even understand. But we use much broader strokes now because we want people inside the Beltway to enjoy it as much as folks in Flint, Lansing, Peoria, Seattle, wherever we go.
Let me explain my views. They all shut up and vote for me. The White House is my destiny. You ask why you shut up and vote for me. You want details of my plans. The great new jobs beat the odds and stop Iran.
Do you ever have audience that come up to you afterwards, or maybe even somebody that you're lampooning in the show come up to you that's seen it and say maybe that was a step too far, or is it they kind of understood that it's all in good fun?
Well, you know, I think that's part of it. I mean, unless you just have no idea what we are and you just show up, and you are a huge fan of, you know, whoever, we've had people come up and say, oh, I don't think it's very nice of you to pick on the president like that. And our kind of response is, well, you know, one, what did you think you were coming to see in a political show? But two, boy, isn't it great we live in a country where we can do that and not end up in jail.
You mentioned a while ago that you tend to be busier, certainly during election years. Does that, conversely, is it easier then to write during election years? Because this is an annual sort of review.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we get this, that the four-year trend, and actually the most fun is kind of in the primary season because you typically have so many characters. I mean, Republicans, of course, had way too many characters, and the Democrats were not exactly loaded up this year, but just to give us, you know, Bernie on the national stage was a good source of material. You get to the point that the show – this month or, you know, whatever we are, 6 weeks away from the elections, it's kind of a self-perpetuating at this point. I mean, it's just moving along, and like I say, unless there is some kind of earth-shattering story that breaks, the show pretty much stays the way it is at this point.
Now, this weekend, Capital Steps will be appearing both in Flint, Michigan, as well as in Lansing on Monday coming up. How many different kind of touring troops are there of Capital Steps?
Well, we're a mix-and-match bunch, and we have the ability to be in four places at once if we need to be, which this time of year we pretty much are always in four places at once. So, that cast that's heading up there will probably be out for, maybe 10 days or so. And then they'll come back, and we'll see if we can shuffle anybody around. But, it's our travel guy is a miracle worker this time of year, getting everybody to where they need to be.
I'm not indicted. I'm so excited. County and the GOP can all go and fight it.
I have decided you were misguided. And I hope this email miscue is now through.
Let's talk through some of the songs. How do you then approach a song for the Capital Steps, some of the ones that are coming up?
Well, you know, there's not really a tried and true method. We obviously search through, like, the Great American Songbook and Broadway shows to kind of get, hopefully, songs that most people know. Vast majority of the audience certainly, hopefully, will know them because that's what makes a song parody kind of fun when you kind of know the song and you're anticipating maybe what's coming up or guessing maybe what the cover is and things like that. Occasionally, we try to break out something a little newer, maybe a pop song. But, pop songs, there's not a whole lot of universal pop songs that, you know, people from 20 to 60 or 70 know these days. You know, the Macarena might have been the last great pop song. But sometimes you're driving in the car, you hear a song come on, it sparks an idea. Other times, just something in the way an article is written or a news story sparks an idea. And then other times you think, oh, there's something out there. We need to do something on this. And you maybe search through the rhyming dictionary for a while and then see if you can match that up with any tunes that's rambling in your brain. So lots of different ways that the songs come into place.
Do you ever have to deal with rights clearances for the songs that you're parodying? That's, you know, because rights clearances are certainly something that are trending for the past half decade or so.
Yeah, I know we're fortunate in the way that parody laws have been ruled on that we don't have to get law. And part of it's because sometimes it could take you years to get the rights to a song. You know, if I'm just a recording artist and I want to record somebody's tune, it could take a while. Whereas they understand the parody, you know, has to be very quick and timely. So, the courts have been kind to parody writers.
It seems like there's a big kind of pressure to also make sure that you're equal opportunity offending, and I think there's a good example of that in the Melanie song that you, Melanie Sofka, that song.
Yeah, I mean, it is something we're conscious of because nobody wants to go and everybody's willing to laugh at their own person, but they also don't want to be browbeaten and just feel like that 90% of the jokes are at their expense and hardly anything across the aisle. But, you know, the Melody song, Brand New Pair of Roller Skates, which we changed into Brand New Pair of Candidates, I think it probably pretty much encapsulates a lot of people's opinion on this election.
Doubly so after the debate as well.
Let's forget. We've got. I wouldn't vote for Trump or Clinton for a school mascot. I've been watching the race a while. I don't like what I see. someone like Tom Brady.
We've been speaking with Mark Eaton, the co-author of this year's and for several past years, the Capital Steps Review, kind of that review of songs and skits lampooning the current political climate here in the United States. More information about the performances coming up this Sunday, October 2nd at the Whiting in Flint. More information at thewhiting.com, as well as Monday's rather shortened performance, Monday, October 3rd, part of the Lansing Symphony Orchestra benefit called the Lansing Town Hall, the 63rd Celebrity Lecture Series. More information about that Monday performance with the Capital Steps Review at lansingsymphony.org. Mark Eaton, co-author of the Capital Steps, thanks very much for joining us here on Current State.
Hey, thanks much.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Coming up on Current State, there's a cool new MSU program aptly titled MSU Shadows that's turning down trees into furniture and works of art. We'll learn more from Current State contributor Kurt Hines. That's coming up later this hour on Current State. Welcome back to Current State on WKAR 90.5 FM. I'm Kyle Malin from the Michigan Information and Research Service, filling in for Mark Bayshore. Well, in case you haven't heard yet, our next Pop-Up Stories live storytelling event is tomorrow evening. It's going to be at Reach Studio Arts Center in Lansing at 6 p.m. Our own Current State producer and Morning Edition host, Brooke Allen, will be our mistress of ceremonies. Our theme this time around is turning over a new leaf. So come on out and hear some great stories. And if you're inspired by the theme and you'd like to tell a story of your own, we still have room for storytellers. You can email us at currentstate@wkar.org to sign up. This will be our last Pop-Up Stories of the year, so be sure not to miss it. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Kyle Malin. The East Lansing Public Library has needed some fixing up for a long time, and the second and final phase of a large project is coming to a close. Current State's Scott Pohl is here with more on the work done at the library and the celebration they're planning for this weekend. Where did the money for this project come from, Scott?
You might recall, Kyle, that an anonymous private donor stepped forward with $1.5 million to spruce up the inside of the library in April of 2015. Along the way, over the last year, other important improvements have been made. I visited the East Lansing Public Library yesterday to talk with Director Kristen Shelley about the work they've had done, which you'll hear in the background is still going on in a rush to get ready for Saturday's reopening ceremony. She tells me that the donor had very few stipulations on how his gift would be spent.
The one thing he did ask for was a soundproof room so that kids could practice music, because he was a musician as a young person and he didn't have any place to practice his music. So we were able to do that. He also asked for a small stage, so we now have a portable stage in our meeting room. So we started with a building committee of 18 people, which is a very large building committee, but we had people from the community, from the city of East Lansing, from the Friends of the Library Board, from the Board of Trustees for the library, and library staff, all represented on this building committee. And we met with various architects, and we wanted an open space. We knew we wanted a larger teen area. We wanted color in our children's area. And we wanted a really great gathering place for the community, and a place the community would love to be and to love to just kind of come and sit and talk with each other in. And the architect that rose to the top was C2AE. They have a Lansing office and a Grand Rapids office. And it just went from there. They actually did a ton of work up front without even knowing, where $1.5 million would get us. They did a phased plan. So there's actually six phases to the building project, going from $500,000 up to $11 million. Because to get the East Lansing Public Library where it should be, with a 25,000 square foot addition, it would cost $11 million. So
you've stuck within that $1.5 million you originally knew you had, right?
We have for the renovations. However, this building never had a fire suppression system. So that, of course, had to be added for code. And we had a huge section of the roof that needed to be replaced for the last 10 years. So we had to do that. And then we had some unexpected surprises throughout the renovation. So we had to take care of some eroded plumbing in restrooms that we were not planning on renovating. So the total projects is probably more like 1.7 million at this point, maybe 1.8, just because the fire suppression system was over 100,000, as was the roof, as was the plumbing. So it just kept escalating the price. But the majority is the 1.5 million from the donor. He got it kickstarted, and we're going to be ready for October 1st.
So where did the extra money come from?
We had saved money in our fund balance over the years. We had, you know, worked lean, and we had cut, and we had amassed a nice sum so that we knew when we were going into this, if we had to, we could increase the cost. But we knew we needed a fire suppression system. I mean, that's without question.
Since our last visit here at the library, tell me about the final phase of the project. What was included in this last phase that you're wrapping up right now?
What we added in, or what got done in phase two, was the teen area, the plumbing that I just mentioned. We created a quiet study area, and now we're shelving every single book. Every single book came off of a shelf and has to go back on. We are cleaning the books because of all the dust that happens with construction, and we are placing furniture as fast as we possibly can.
You know, when people move, the worst thing to move is the books and maybe the record albums, those of us who still have some vinyl. So that has been an enormous task, and it's done book by book by book.
It absolutely is, because we need books to be in their Dewey order or in their Alpha order, and the same with our CDs. We have a CD collection and DVDs, all of that, and much of it was in storage because we only had half of the library open. So yes, it's coming out, and while it was covered by Visqueen, it still got a tremendous amount of dust on it because of the ceiling tiles and everything. But yes, that has been the slow process of putting everything back together.
You've moved the Maker Studio completely to be housed here in the library now.
Yes, we have. We would love to keep a Maker Studio downtown. However, we just don't have the staff to do justice to both Maker Studios. So we'll open with a new Maker Studio that is about 1,000 square feet, maybe a little bit bigger, maybe 1,100 square feet, complete with 3D printers, 3D scanners, sewing machines, an Arduino lab, Lego, high-end Adobe publishing, and much, much more. High-end Mac computers, podcasting capabilities, and that in that area is where the soundproof room will be.
You also have some renovated meeting space here, and that's something I'm not sure a lot of people have known about or thought about, that the East Lansing Public Library is a place that can be used for meetings. Tell me more about how that will be part of the program here at the library.
Absolutely. So we have a large community meeting room space, which we do rent out, but then we added smaller meeting rooms that can divide, can be smaller yet even from what they are, that will hold tutors or, you know, small meetings, and those are kind of first come, first serve basis. We also had added a quiet study area, which will be nice. We hope students will come down and use it. We hope community will come in and use it. We also added the cafe, the cyber cafe, complete with vending machines, and every single table in there has a plug so people can plug in their devices or sit and talk over a cup of coffee or whatever and just, you know, share what's happening in the community with each other. And that's what we're really hoping for. This is the community's library. This is your library. We want you to come and enjoy it.
When you think about the totality of what was in the library before and what will be here starting Saturday and beyond, what maybe excites you most about what you're going to be able to do that you weren't able to in the past?
Well, I really like the fact that we've made it a much more open floor plan so that we have much better sight lines throughout. And I think we'll be able to better engage the teens that come after school because we have a bigger space. And the children's area is delightful. We added early childhood literacy stations for children so that they can, that are computers built just for small children to learn literacy and to engage. And I think that's just wonderful. I mean, that's what the library is all about. The other thing is that it just seems to flow better as a library, and we'll have stronger Wi-Fi, and we have more data on electric where we need it. And from the day I started here 5 years ago, I've always said we need more data and electric, and now we've got it. Will it take us 20 years into the future? Who knows? But we certainly have it for now and several years beyond.
We're talking with Kristen Shelley, who's director of the East Lansing Public Library. Their big reopening after a huge renovation project is slated for Saturday. What's your level of optimism that the space is really going to be ready for your reopening at noon on Saturday?
You know, people keep telling me it'll get done, and we are working long hours. The staff has been phenomenal. They've come in. We've had volunteers come in and help us. It will get done on Saturday for our noon ribbon cutting. I hope everybody comes out.
One final question. Truth be told, it won't all be done by Saturday. What remains to be done on your schedule beyond Saturday?
Probably getting more of the collection that was in storage out. We'll have a tremendous amount out already, but we may not get the entire collection out. Also, we have items like extra shelving that we need to have. We're going to have Habitat or Volunteers of America come pick up. That won't happen until after we open. And probably tweaking. We'll tweak the furniture to where we want it. We'll decide, you know, oh, this isn't quite what we had in mind. And so we'll keep tweaking. And, you know, it won't be perfect. It won't be perfect probably a year from now. So we'll keep working at it and keep working at it. But it's going to look great. And it's going to be a new space and a fresh, clean, open space for the community.
A $1.5 million plus renovation project is wrapping up at the East Lansing Public Library. There will be a ribbon cutting ceremony and a celebration at noon on Saturday, a couple of hours, noon to 2, here at the East Lansing Public Library on Abbott Road. We've been talking with the library's director, Kristen Shelley. Thank you so much, and good luck with the completion of the renovation project here.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
There's a cool new MSU program, aptly titled MSU Shadows, that's turning downed trees into furniture and works of art. Greening of the Great Lakes host and Current State contributor Kurt Heinze has more.
MSU, we love thy shadows.
Well, if I were to say MSU Shadows, I'll bet most of you would rightly think of that lovely university alma mater. And you might even think of trees because of the well-known phrase from the song, Beneath the Pines Will Gather.
Well, beneath the pines will gather.
But how many of you would conjure up visions of equally lovely and elegant wood products? With me to talk about the MSU Shadows you're probably not aware of is Dan Brown. Dan is a sustainable bioproduct specialist in MSU's Department of Forestry. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Give us some background on the origins and purpose of the MSU Shadows program.
We have many trees on campus, so they're cherished by our student body, our faculty. They are a teaching resource for our students within forestry and horticulture and other classes. So we bring down about 300 trees a year on campus. So safety concerns, disease, stress, drought, just urban stress in general, and some construction removal. So originally these trees were either chipped up and burnt in the power plant or chipped up and used as mulch. So either one of those end uses aren't a real desirable way to use these trees that we love so much. So we decided we could reclaim these trees and hopefully make a heirloom product that'll stick around folks' homes for a while.
Well, it's a lot of us who've been around campus for a long time often wondered what happened. I mean, even this summer we've had a couple of pretty fierce storms mm-hmm. blow through where you've lost some trees. I mean, what a sustainable way to repurpose those trees that have been blown over.
Yes. And it's a common problem across municipalities. So MSU wasn't the only one to get hit by the ice storm in 2013. We're not the only ones that get hit by this storm back in June, East Lansing got it. And a lot of their wood is at the same fate. Municipalities across the country are chipping up wood and either burning it. Some of it gets landfilled, unfortunately. So there is a movement to start utilizing urban wood.
Tell us a little bit about the broader umbrella program, the Sustainable Wood Recovery Initiative.
So the MSU Shadows Collection funds this program. So with those funds, we're hoping to plant more trees on campus. So we're completing the circle. So we have these trees that we love. There's people been proposed to underneath these trees. We study under them. We love them. They grow up and they die, and then they were gone. So now we want to complete this circle. So part of the funds from the MSU Shadows Collection is going to go back into planting more trees on campus, so continuing this resource that we have. And then the other portion of the funds are going to go into educational opportunities. So we've already integrated the mill and some of the programs into forestry classes right now. We hope to have a full-on forestry course, urban wood utilization, and going through the whole process from the tree coming down all the way to selling a product.
My guest is Dan Brown. He is a sustainable bioproduct specialist at MSU's Department of Forestry. We're talking about the MSU Shadows program. So we've talked sustainability from an environmental standpoint and from an economic standpoint. Let's talk about the dimension that we call sort of the social and cultural leg of the sustainability stool. Mm-hmm. This wood, once it's milled and killed and all of that, goes to local artists.
Yes, so we are also supporting the broader community with this program. Right, currently, we are working with 6 different local artisans. The furthest out that we are going is Ann Arbor. We have one in Lowell, Brighton. So that's kind of the outside diameter of our reach right at the moment. But yes, we are working with outside folks, and they're creating awesome products. We try to pick out folks that have their own unique styles and can bring their own flavors to the table.
So here, MSU Trees are supporting local artists who make these products, in turn support the tree plantings on Michigan State's campus. You've
yes.
got a closed loop there
mm-hmm.
of sustainability.
And that was the idea, yep.
What types of products, and where can folks find out more about them?
Right now, we are selling our products to the MSU Surplus Store and MSUShadows.com. We hope to branch out later on in the future, but right now, that's where we're at. We kind of have the full gamut of products, so you can have a dining room table. So we have some great live-edge coffee tables. We have one of our artisans. He does a more mid-century modern look, so some real crazy-looking designs. We have a few Herman Miller style tables, which are got a very unique story. Not only is the wood reclaimed on the top, but we've upcycled old Herman Miller table bases that were kind of laying around at Surplus. And so there's a sustainability story kind of plugged in twice to these tables.
And yeah.
we've revived one of his bases and right. thrown a new a reclaimed wood top on top. So you can get the big furniture, and then stepping down from that, we have diploma frames. We cater to bachelor's, master's, and PhD frames, and they come in a multitude of flavors, styles, and colors. We have cutting boards, wine bottle stoppers, pens, business card holders, cutting boards, so we kind of run the gamut on all the way around.
I spent some time on the website looking at some of the different products. I mean, they are lovely products, and they're made by Michigan artists, and they come from MSU mm-hmm. wood. What a great thing to frame a diploma, a card holder, a table, because it's a talking point around the house.
Yeah, and another great plug on the products is, at Michigan State University, we have such a variety of trees that, it's a teaching resource. We have trees that don't grow here, so we've made them grow here. So eventually they succumb and we get that wood. So we have some species that you won't find on the commercial market in these products. And some of the colors and things that come out with the trees being stressed on campus is also unique.
Wow, so just things that you would not see.
Yeah, yeah. So many of our products you're not going to find at, your box stores or local places.
And you're supporting tree plantings on campus.
Yes.
When you're buying those products, in addition to the local artists.
Yep.
I mean, it sounds like a win-win-win.
That's what we're hoping to get here.
Okay, so the MSU Surplus Store, or go online to MSU Shadows for those wonderful, lovely products. I've been talking with Dan Brown. He's a sustainable bioproduct specialist at MSU's Department of Forestry, and he leads the Department of Forestry's input and coordination of the MSU Shadows program. Dan, thanks so much for being on the program.
All right, thanks for having me.
Sing our love for alma mater, and thy praises MSU.
Hear more from Kirk Heinze on MSU Today, Sunday afternoons at 4 o'clock on AM 870. And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, NPR political correspondent Don Gagne has covered many an election in his time, crisscrossing the country wherever the campaign trail may lead. But did you know this venerable public radio voice got his start right here at MSU? We'll hear about it in Don Gagne's own words. Plus, cast members from the Starz horror comedy Ash and Evil Dead are hosting a Season 2 advanced screening and Q&A panel tomorrow night at MSU. And actors Ted Raimi, Dana DeLorenzo, and Ray Santiago will join us to talk about why Michigan plays such an important role in the new season. That and much more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Kyle Malin. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR. We'll talk to you tomorrow.